The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on the programme...
We are special, and you could make a case that the universe must be for us, because as far as we know, we're the only entities that can look around and think, ooh, is all this just for us?
Well, at the beginning of every edition of this podcast, I ask, who am I, where am I, and where am I going? But we usually edit that part out. Not this week, though. I'll be talking to the UK's most famous, most loved science reporter, Tim Radford, about the address book, one man's attempt to find his place in the universe, starting with a house number.
Empathy is a neglected resource. I even say that empathy is, you know, the most important human resource we have.
Director of the Autism Centre in Cambridge, Simon Baron Cohen, joins us to explore the human capacity for empathy and to explore his new theory on why we're so cruel. And we'll also go through some of the most important science stories this week, including a possible ban on patenting in stem cell research and a lack of funds at the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. I can assure you that empathy rather than cruelty was at play in gathering The Guardian's elite science team this week. With us this week are The Guardian's Ian Sample and The Observer's science editor Robin McKee. Also with us in the studio is Tim Radford, a giant of the science journalism world and a tireless advocate of public understanding of great scientific ideas. He was a member of The Guardian's staff for 32 years. He's also served on the UK Committee for the International Decade for Disaster Reduction and lectured around the world on science and the media. Tim's latest book, several years in the making, is The Address Book. Now, I had hoped, Tim, that you were going to just publish your file of facts for the benefit of other science journalists. But in fact, The Address Book is more of a philosophical and scientific rumination on our place in the universe. It starts with something that I think many children might do, I certainly did, which is to write your address in your exercise book and then carry on from your postcode and country all the way up to the universe. Tell us just why you did this many, many years ago.
Sometimes I ask myself why I didn't do the postcode. And of course, the answer was that when I was a kid, there weren't postcodes. These were quite new things. So I skipped the postcode. Thank you very much. But I was fascinated by the idea that one never quite knows where one is. And this uncertainty gets larger and larger as the scale of on which you try to think gets more and more peculiar. And if anyone who's ever had a house is aware that if even a really stable lump of bricks and mortar keeps moving around and you suddenly find you can't shut a door, and the only explanation for not being able to shut a door at all, or indeed lock one, is that the house itself has moved on the ground. It's tilted down or sideways. The ground has shrunk beneath your feet. And I had an old house, so it moved more than most. And I just started thinking about this phenomenon. I started thinking about it even more when we experienced subsidence. And we were involved in a great deal of digging to put 8 feet of underpinning. And the surveyor said, yeah, all these houses are going to end up in the sea one day. And I just had this wonderful vision of Sussex as it must have been once, and the house as it will be one day, and started from there.
So the book starts with your house in Hastings, and you talk about the place where it is, the who's owned the house. It's as much history as it is, well, eventually cosmology, and there's also a bit of rock and roll in there as well. Is it a memoir? Is it about science? I mean, how would you sort of put this book's into its place?
I think the kindest word would be reflection. It would certainly be a geographical reflection. I've used the word memoir once or twice because as soon as I started thinking about where I lived, I had this other uneasy sense that it wasn't actually my house. And that the house that I imagined myself living in had a front and back veranda and a corrugated iron roof. And of course, when I was a kid, the sun was always in the north, and everything that I read came from Europe, so that I actually believed the sun to be in the south, because that's what the book said, even though I could visibly see that it wasn't. And then I started thinking about how addresses play in your mind. We all have this other geography, 100 Acre Wood, for instance, where Winnie the Pooh lived. and Heartbreak Hotel, which is a place you can check into with a great deal of pleasant misery when you're 16.
Hotel California. You can't leave that one.
Yes, Hotel California would have done, but not for my generation, I'm afraid. And all of these things actually create a kind of personal geography. So it is a personal book.
Is just I'll ask one more thing before I open it up to Robin and Ian. Is there such a thing as place, really? Because as you go further and further out from your study in Hastings to the scale of the entire universe, well, the Earth's rotating, the Earth's moving around the Sun, the solar system moves around the center of the galaxy, which is flying around at hundreds of kilometers per second. We're not in one place ever.
No.
Our molecules are not in any sort of single place. And then the other question is, where do you measure place from relative to? There's no center of the universe. These are two very big questions in one, but maybe you can answer that.
I can't answer them because for the reasons that you've outlined, but I do end the book with a little thought experiment, which I just imagine that I could be like Star Trek, like Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk and Star Trek, and be an immense in the other quadrant of the universe. And setting a course for home. And of course, as soon as you do that, you realize you couldn't. Because supposing that your galaxy or your supercluster of galaxies was in view, they wouldn't look now like they were then, because, of course, you'd be looking across 600 million light years of space. And if you'd done this magic jump, you'd be looking back at a world that wasn't there at all.
In our lifetimes, in our human sort of blink of the eye when it comes to the history of the Earth, nothing changes. The coastlines look the same and the mountains look the same. But over millions of years, these were very different. I mean, hundreds of millions of years ago, there was just one continent. Now there's many. It will change again. And everything we do is looking at it from our own human point of view. And there's a chapter in your book about this Copernican principle where every few generations or so, scientists or thinkers essentially make us less special. And is this your attempt to make us less special?
No, I think in a way we are special, and you could make a case that the universe must be for us, because we're the only entities that can look around and think, ooh, is all this just for us? The fact that we can think that, even if it's not just for us, the fact that we can think that does make us rather the center of things, doesn't it?
And find meaning in it. Because if you abstract out of it...
Meaning's a bit harder. Quite a few people have actually discussed this notion that we have a sense of purpose. And the only thing that tells us we have a sense of purpose is, of course, that we think we've got a sense of purpose.
Well, that's what I mean. Whether there is an actual absolute meaning or not, we still find something.
Yeah, we go looking for it all the time.
Robin?
No, I was just thinking about not so much address book as origins as the issue of it's not necessarily the place of the book, but where we're from is actually an issue. I mean, you can take the address book and push it back to sub-Saharan Africa 5 or 6 million years ago and say, well, there's a good address you could start from, for instance.
I did have a great deal of pleasure at the discovery many years ago that the Act of Union between England and Scotland occurred about 100 million years ago, rather violently and under the water when there was no one around to look.
We've been suffering ever since.
Tim's book, The Address Book, is out now, and you can find details on our blog. Now, we're going to talk about this week's science news stories. Let's start with you, Ian, and a story about how potentially there's a problem with patenting around stem cell technology.
Well, there was a letter in Nature last week where Austin Smith, the director of the Wellcome Trust Stem Cell Centre at Cambridge, with a bunch of other scientists, were writing about the what they see as a looming threat from the European Court of Justice, which does appear poised to hand down a ruling that will ban patents on work that surrounds human embryonic stem cells. And they are saying that that will be a major problem for them, because if they do lab work, not only they are actually contractually obliged in their funding to get intellectual property rights on any discoveries they find, if they can't get that kind of protection over their inventions, then companies won't come in at the later stages to actually fund that stuff through clinical trials and then through to treatment. So they're saying that they're using strong language on this, and they are saying that this could really scupper the sort of the human embryonic stem cell part of the European bioindustry. Now, this would be a kind of, in their view, Europe shooting itself in the foot, while countries like Japan, China, US can carry on with their own patenting and get IPs to the point that we may have to buy in the sort of rights to use expertise that we can't actually protect ourselves. So it's causing huge furore, actually. And
just to explain what it means to patent a stem cell or a stem cell technology. What is it they want to actually patent?
Well, the key thing here is that nobody is patenting cells or embryos or anything that you could constitute as saying that this is actually part of the human body and there is some sort of sanctity over that, which is the motivation of this legal case. The legal case, it has an awful long history. This was kicked off in 2004 where Greenpeace challenged a German academic who was trying to patent a technique for turning human embryonic stem cells into neural cells, the idea of using those to use them either in development of treatments for brain diseases or you know, things like that. Now, the work that these guys are doing is not about, say, they're not trying to patent the cells themselves. They're saying that we do need to have protection over, say, if they come up with a technique that says, I can take this cell and turn it into something that is potentially clinically useful. It's that technique that they want to do. What the European Court of Justice looks likely to do, because the adjudicator has already published his opinion, and he says, well, you can't get away from the fact that this technology has been developed from embryonic stem cells. Embryonic stem cells ultimately came from embryos that were discarded from IVF clinics. You are still destroying the embryos in that process. So if you go back far enough, there is an embryo involved. So that affects then the patent on this technology. And he even goes so far as compare it to the fact that if you were taking kidneys out of people and doing research on those kidneys and coming up with something patentable, you should be able to patent that either. So he's making really quite strong sort of, you know, comparisons.
Tim, is it a bad idea to ban the patent of what essentially are human products?
It's not a bad idea. It's not a good idea. It is a difficult idea, however. A drugs company, because of the constraints that there are in safety and in the protection of research, a drugs company will spend, well, it used to be 100 million and 10 years, but it's probably 10 billion and 15 years now, trying to bring something to market. And only about 1 in 7 products ever gets to market, and only about 1 of those ever makes any money. So there is a great deal of investment. And what the companies are looking for is protection. And they don't get a lot of protection from a patent. They get a 17-year start, but at least 7 of those years, the information is available to everybody else. It's just the use of the patent for commercial purposes, which they're protecting. And they'll be lucky to have a 6 or 7 year run with a clear run with a product at the end of it, always assuming it makes money. So you could make a case and say that this is a constraint on medicine itself. But I'm not absolutely sure of that, since most of the great advances in medicine have happened anyway.
Well, Robin, this is just, Ian said, it's shooting yourself in the foot, because America won't ban this, Japan won't ban this. We'll just lose all our scientists to those countries.
I mean, there's several things. First of all, Britain got an enormous lead because of George Bush's decision to ban federally funded stem cell research. And top American researchers came to this country because of that. And we've built up quite a good base here in this country. And we're at risk of losing that. For a decision that seems to me kind of perverse, really kind of almost philosophically perverse, you can take anything back to an embryo stage at some point and just about label every piece of medicine as coming from that. I can't follow the guy's logic at all. More to the point, do drug companies deserve patent protection? I think the answer is almost certainly yes, because we live in a capitalist society, whether we like it or not, and the people who are going to make the drugs for us are individuals who work for a company that are responsible to their shareholders. Much as we dislike the concept in our liberal, you know, in our liberal midst here, I don't think we've got any option but to back that system, in which case you need patent protection.
Ian, why is Greenpeace involved in this, given they're an environmental charity? You'd think more concerned about oil drilling and climate change. Well, why are they involved?
Well, this is Greenpeace Germany, who is you know, arguably more radical than the Greenpeace that we may normally deal with here in the UK. And the issues over life and embryos and such like have, for historical reasons, become very sensitive in Germany. They have some of the strictest legislation over stem cell research already. Now, what the Greenpeace challenge involves is a concern that embryos could be used in an industrial manner, as they phrase it, that there could be a commercialization of embryos. And I think a lot of people will balk at that and see some concern over that. But it misses a point in that there are more than 100 different stem cell lines that have been grown ad infinitum from embryos that were collected many years ago. And these scientists use stem cell lines which have been grown and grown and grown, and you just apply and you get the cells. You don't go to an embryo each time you need a cell and you know, cut it apart and stuff like that. So there's sort of I don't know if it's a disingenuous, but there is sort of some misunderstanding perhaps of actually the source of these cells and even what the scientists are trying to do with them. They're not trying to patent the cells. They're not trying to set up factories whereby you would put embryos in and you would get stem cells out that we then cure disease with. It's such a sensitive issue in Germany in particular that I think the ruling will probably go against the stem cell scientists.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Okay, well, let's move on to a story about the rest of the universe. This is a story about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, something we've discussed on this show lots before. We've had the senior astronomer from SETI, Seth Shostak, on talking about what aliens might look like, when we might find them. It's a story that kind of inspired Carl Sagan to write Contact, the novel that was made into a film in the 90s starring Jodie Foster. And it's one of those things that is trying to answer a question which I suppose any interested person asks, which is, are we alone in the universe? And for 50 years, it's been staring up at the sky, looking for radio signals, so TV signals from extraterrestrials, essentially. It hasn't heard anything yet, by the way. And it's just run out of money. So after 50 years, they just built a $50 million array specifically for this. So until now, they've used downtime on other telescopes around the world and in space to sort of hunt for these signals. But now Paul Allen, who is one of the co-founders of Microsoft, donated a whole bunch of money to help SETI build an entire array near San Francisco. And they've built the array, but because of the economic downturn, the university that actually runs the array can't afford to keep it running. So this is the University of California, Berkeley. It's had its money cut from the National Science Foundation. It's had its money cut from the state of California. The running costs are something like $3 million a year, and it can't afford it. So essentially, SETI is in hibernation, and it can stay in hibernation for about 3 or 4 months in the hope that someone comes along with $3 million. Or $4 million a year on a long-term basis. Otherwise, they're going to have to just scrap the whole thing. And we're going to our biggest and pretty much only search for extraterrestrial life is going to stop. Does this make anyone else slightly depressed about the world?
It makes me. I thought newspapers were in a bad way, but no, apparently, you know, they're even worse out there. It strikes me a bit incompetent. I mean, doesn't they have $3 million in the bank just in case? You know, I mean,
are we alone? That really is the most extraordinary thing. It's at the bottom of all the questions about about discovery. Are we? Is there anyone else out there? And you cut now to planet Tharg, 50 light years away.
I thought there wasn't any other planet Tharg in earlier on.
And out in the garden, someone's saying, did you hear the phone? And then you go inside and pick up the phone, and of course there's no one there, and you think, no. And then you realise you've got a missed call. You don't know who's from.
Somebody's just put the plug in the line. I'm really sorry about this.
Just imagine, we could have just missed them.
Yep.
In that 3 months, 4 months.
Well, the other thing is, of course, it's only now in the past few years, I mean, I wouldn't even say decade, that SETI research is being taken seriously. Astrobiology has become a big thing in science. Before that, it was the kind of place that crazy people sort of thought about as extraterrestrials, and it wasn't enough money to look at it. But Robin, there was a there was a whole Royal Society session on this last year, which you wrote about.
Yes.
And this is a serious science now.
Well, I mean, Astronomer Royal was there. He was taking it very seriously.
Well, Astronomer Royal has all sorts of other things.
And that was before, that's before he came in the money, that's true.
Yes, that's right. But no, but seriously, I mean, astrobiology, people are considering what it might be like to have an evolution on other planets, have how, what the physical forms of these things might look like, what other communications methods there might be. There are obviously physical challenges, but it's a serious science, this.
Well, also, you understand yourself better when you compare yourself with something else that, you know, has at least achieved intelligence. I mean, the thing about Homo sapiens, it's wiped out every other kind of competing intelligence on the planet, and then we're now wiping out the kind of the residue, the great apes, and we will not really know, you know, what it is that made us so special if we don't have anything to compare ourselves with. And this is one classic way of finding out.
The research has thrown up some wonderful stories. Quite one of them, quite recently this week, the proposition that on a distant planet with two suns, the foliage might be black. And yes. I like the idea of a black forest. I mean, in a place other than Germany, of course.
Yes.
It was just
why would it be black? Because it would just have to absorb so much light.
Yes.
Ian?
I just want to add a note of misery to the SETI story. That is that there's sort of this assumption that if SETI were to pick up a signal, then you call in President Obama, you get Seth Shostak and a few other clever people together, you get Paul Davis in the room, and you say, okay, how should we go and talk to them? And you bring in some linguists. And, you know, what would be more likely is that by the time we received any signal that was out there, that civilization would be dead by the time we hear about it. And it almost exacerbates our loneliness. Even if we could pick up these signals, it would be these brief bursts of a civilization's competence in producing radio waves. It's not that we're going to be able to hook up a chat. They're too far away. And we're not going to get there because we can't even get to the moon reliably. And so there's this almost exasperating thing, if we did find a signal, that there was someone out there, but we know by the time we've heard they're already
gone. You're only making that conclusion, though, from modern science. I mean, who knows? In 200 years, what we know about how to travel through wormholes and...
Are you saying a faster-than-light drive is impossible? That's outrageous.
Without sort of breaking physics. I mean, Paul Davis, who you mentioned there, who's an astrophysicist at the Arizona State University, wrote a book about whether we're alone last year. He's been interested in astrobiology for a very long time. His response to this was just that it would be an utter tragedy, he said, if a unique research program was abandoned for the cost of a few miles of motorway. Our society squanders vast sums on trivia and entertainment, yet can't find the small change to address the burning issue of whether we're alone in the universe, which says it all, really.
Yes.
It says it all, really. $3 million. I mean, Robin, you probably have enough in the Observer budget to sort of stick a few years
donate some of my expenses to see them through the next 6 months.
No, but I mean, the one thing that Seth Shostak, who is the senior astronomer there, was saying was that SETI research for about 50 years has been funded essentially privately. NASA, none of these guys are really funding this stuff. There is some basic astrobiology research being funded. And as we said, the running costs of the telescope were going to be paid for $3 million a year by some state funding. But essentially, the whole search has been private. It's been individuals, Paul Allen, as I mentioned, Carl Sagan himself, Arthur C. Clarke, they all donated, and people put their own money to this. Mm. I mean, it's bound to be that you hope that somebody out there who's sort of curious and rich will just bail them out.
But they haven't been. It's the eerie silence. Nobody's come forward with the millions.
They should just get Mark Zuckerberg in and make it the Facebook SETI project or something hideous like that, where any alien that gets in touch has to put out whether they're looking for a partner or, you know, sort of their whereabouts and put constant updates on life on their planet.
I'm horrified to think that actually might work. Okay, well, that's all we have time for today. So if you want to read more about any of that stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Ian's going to stay with us, and he'll be telling me why he's been so cruel to me before and after the podcast all these years. It's the time in the podcast now where we ask the Hannaford question. For those who aren't regular listeners, you might wonder, what is the Hannaford question? Well, our loyal listener, Rob Hannaford, asked that we get as many of our guests as possible to answer one thing, which is, if you had one question in the universe that you could have answered, what would it be?
Well, I'm Dr. John Taylor, and the one question in the world which I would like answered is the inspiration that Harrison had to devote a whole lifetime to solving one problem, and that was a clock which could go to sea, and how he, as a joiner, was able to out-invent, out-perform, and out-manufacture all the London clockmakers of his day. And he made the most accurate clock in the world, his own personal regulator that's here on show in the Science Museum, and he made that out of wood. And where did he get his inspiration to perform feats that cleverer men, by their standards in London, couldn't even contemplate finding a solution for?
And if you've not seen Dr. John Taylor's magnificent new timekeeping, or rather time-eating device, the chronophage, it's on display at the Science Museum there in London. Now, from the cruel march of time to the onward march of cruelty. Ian Sample has been speaking to Professor Simon Baron-Cohen, who's the director of the Autism Research Centre at Cambridge University. He's a leader when it comes to subjects such as autism research, psychiatry and experimental psychology. His new book is called 0 Degrees of Empathy, A New Theory of Human Cruelty. Ian, just tell us what the premise of this book is.
The basic idea behind it is that if you look at work that's gone on to try and understand what evil is, to try and explain why someone does something evil, why people do bad things, the argument gets a bit circular because you end up saying, well, so-and-so did something horrific because they are evil, and it becomes an explanation in its own right. And what Simon Baron Cohen is saying is that you need to move beyond this. You need to find another way of framing what evil is to try and get some kind of purchase on it, to be able to grasp it and to perhaps understand it better. And if you can understand it better, then perhaps you can start thinking about what to do about it. And his idea is that evil is a consequence occasionally of having exceptionally low empathy, or 0 degrees of empathy, as he calls his book. Now, the idea there being that you simply start treating other people as objects, that you don't have your ability to put your mind in theirs, to see how your actions and other things going on in the world are affecting other people. And when you start doing that, then the possibility of doing things which are evil then kind of comes around. When I spoke to him, he started to explain his search for an understanding of evil, and it began really with a very personal point of view.
When my father told me when I was about 7 years old that the Nazis had turned Jews into lampshades, and just listening to that phrase, the idea of turning a person into an object, is something that stuck with me as a child. He also told me, you know, other stories about what the Nazis did to different minorities, but the commonality seemed to be that when human beings act in a cruel way, they treat other people as objects. But for me, what's nagged away at me all these years and now decades is how can human beings turn off their empathy, their compassion for a fellow human being, so that they can just treat them as an object? And as a neuroscientist, I also am interested to know what's going on in the brain when we can lose our feelings, our compassion for somebody else, and do awful things.
You talk about there being this sort of historical problem where there's no good explanation for what evil and cruelty really are, even though we recognize them when we see them. I mean, has this area been neglected by science? Has it left it to religious and other domains?
I think religion has tried to explain acts of cruelty for centuries, so they've had a head start on science. It's not that science has completely neglected it, it's just that it's looked at it in very isolated topics. So, for example, the psychopath, to give it its full name, psychopathic personality disorder, and also called antisocial personality disorder, that's been well studied by researchers. But it's just one particular example of a group of individuals who can end up doing nasty things to other people. So the mind of the psychopath, and ultimately the brain of a psychopath, even some of the genetic influences leading to psychopathy, they have been well studied. But in my book, I broaden it, so it's not just a focus on psychopaths. It's looking at what are the different ways in which you can lose your empathy, And being a psychopath is just one of those routes.
Can you talk a bit about where empathy does come in as your attempt to explain evil? What is it that, when you talk about losing empathy, are we talking about an absolute loss, about a permanent loss? And is this something, as you say, there are different shades of losing empathy. Can I lose it in one circumstance compared to another, depending on which part of my neural circuitry is not working properly? Or
yeah, well, that's right. So basically what I've done is try to shift the debate away from these rather theological concepts like evil onto what I would argue is more scientific concepts like empathy. I think the concept of empathy is more explanatory. And that's because you can isolate it in the brain. In my book, I call it the empathy circuit, which is a network of at least 10 regions that seem to be involved when we empathize. But secondly, it's joining acts of cruelty to all of us in the population. So we all have empathy. It's normative. And in the book, I talk about an empathy bell curve or a spectrum, that we're all somewhere on this spectrum. It's not that you either have empathy or you don't. But we, you know, there are individual differences in there. And part of what the book explores is what contributes to where a person ends up on that bell curve.
Do you think there's a lack of empathic people at the top of business, at religion and things like this? And I'm thinking about your example in the book of Desmond Tutu being extraordinarily empathic in the past. And I'm wondering if there are... if there is a lack of people of sufficient empathy at the top that would actually be meaningful to make a difference, if you like.
Well, my book does have a partly political angle to it, or agenda even, in that it's arguing that empathy is a neglected resource. I even say that empathy is, you know, the most important human resource we have, because we can use it to resolve conflict, whether we're talking about domestic conflict or whether we're talking about international conflict. And the problem, I suppose, is that we get into speculation. We don't really know what the empathy levels are of our political leaders. And the example I hold up of someone with very high empathy, Desmond Tutu, again, it's speculation. From his behavior, we could infer that he must have extraordinary levels of empathy to have chaired the Truth and Reconciliation hearings and to have really understood the pain of the victims who needed to be able to disclose their feelings. But we haven't put Desmond Tutu into the scanner, nor have we put our current Prime Minister or other presidents into the scanner. And it may be that that our political system would look very different if we, instead of using, say, legal methods for resolving conflict or military methods for resolving conflict, we prioritised empathy as a tool for resolving conflict.
That was Ian Sample talking to Professor Simon Baron-Cohen. If you want to hear the full interview, you can get that as a Science Weekly extra. There are links on the podcast blog, or it should be in your iTunes feed already. Well, that's all we have for you this week on Science Weekly. A huge thanks to our guests this week, Tim Radford and Simon Baron-Cohen. Thanks also to Ian Sample and Robin McKee. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.